Today is Wednesday, October 4th. We're going to be working on articulations and a little bit of muscle tissue information. The remainder of class is Exam 2 review. So we're looking at articulations and movements in a synovial joint. And keep in mind, synovial joints are ones constructed from synovial membranes, and they are functionally classified as what type of joint? Diagrosis, yeah, which is a freely movable joint. Good. So, you know, just to remind us of last class period, a typical synovial joint has a couple of features there to help us reduce friction. We've got things like articular cartilage, we have synovial fluid, we also have spongy bone in the ends of those bones, so they're not rubbing and grinding past one another. Rather, that spongy bone is great as a shock absorber. Okay, so a lot of features here help these synovial joints, you know, maintain lubrication and reduce friction. Just want to show you some issues with joint problems. You know, this is arthritis, which is inflammation of what? The joint, yeah. So technically the joint itself becomes inflamed. If, however, the ends of the bones become inflamed, now we have a different name for it. Yeah, now it's osteoarthritis, exactly. Rheumatoid arthritis is actually an autoimmune disease. This is one where your body determines that part of that joint should not be there and unfortunately fights against it and causes inflammation. You can see this crippling disease for the hands. Another type of arthritis is called gout. Gout affects men more than women, and I make that point because there's a lot of diseases that affect women more than men. But this is one of those that tends to run more among men, and it has to do with the body's inability to excrete uric acid. And you get uric acid from the breakdown of meat products and proteins. So oftentimes when people have an outbreak of gouty arthritis, guess what they tell them to do with their diet? Stop eating as much meat, yeah. So there are some things, kind of off-the-wall things. They may sound kind of crazy, but pickle juice contains an ingredient that actually helps to reduce gouty arthritis. Imagine how nasty that would be to drink, right? Turmeric, which is in mustard, some people use that to treat gouty arthritis, but they're finding that those ingredients actually help combat those uric acid crystals from building up and causing this inflammation like you see in the joints here. Unfortunately, they attack some of the better, bigger joints of our bodies, like your knees and elbows. These are some common outbreak places for gouty arthritis to take place. So male or female, this tends to run later in life, not necessarily in your younger years. So let's talk about the types of joints that we're covering today. We're going to be talking about linear motion and more particularly about angular motion. At the very top of page 74, you've got linear motion, which is only a few movements that we discuss. And if you think about the way the Queen's Wave, right? This is what we call gliding joint motion or linear motion. You can see that we're not actually changing the angle of any of the articulating bones. But if you do this kind of wave, you actually do change the articulating angle between the carpals and the radius and ulna. So we're going to actually focus on angular motion, which means that we are changing joint angles. All right, so let's talk about the first set there. They are partnered up. Can you demonstrate extension? Good, extension. So what joint are we extending? Elbow. Yep, extending the elbow joint, good. Now can you use that same arm to do flexion? Bend it, right? Okay, so when you bend or reduce the angle of a joint, you're performing flexion. When you extend the joint or straighten out that joint, you're performing what's called extension. If I'm standing, you know, and you think about my hips, knees, that kind of thing, we're looking at extended legs when we're standing. But if you're sitting, what are your knee joints doing? They're flexing, right? So they're being bent. Good. We think of these movements as antagonistic, meaning what?
Against each other.
Against each other, right. And so you may notice when you start studying these muscles, you really start getting into these muscles, flexors and extensors are on opposite sides of a body part. And that can be really, really helpful when you think about it. When you think about extending and flexing, like in the arm area here, you've got flexors for the triceps brachii and an extensor back here for the triceps brachii. So when you're studying those muscles, you know, it may be more helpful to think big picture about those flexors and extensors and where they're set up. All right, what body parts do dorsiflexion and plantar flexion?
Foot.
The foot, good. If you stand on your tiptoes, you are doing what motion? Dorsa. Or plantar?
Plantar,
yeah. You're planting your feet on the floor. If you're driving a car and all of a sudden somebody runs in front of your vehicle, your foot comes up off that gas pedal. Now what you doing?
Dorsiflexion,
yeah. Coast is clear, you push your toes back down on the gas pedal. That's plantar flexion. Good. These are also opposite actions. We call these motions antagonistic. And so the thing to keep in mind is they only occur in the foot area. Okay. So for those going into physical therapy assistant program, you know, sometimes people fall and sprain their ankles. I speak from experience on this one. A lot of times when you fall and sprain your ankle, it's actually a plantar flexion that you end up overdoing. So people fall over their feet, you know, tumbling downstairs or whatnot, rather than actually having a dorsiflexed problem. All right, let's see. Our next pair there are abduction and adduction. AB as a prefix means where?
Away
from. Good. And AD means?
Toward.
Yeah. So when you think about abduction and adduction, you may think about doing jumping jacks. We move our arms away, move them back toward the midline. You can also abduct your fingers and adduct them back together. So spreading your fingers apart is abduction. Putting your fingers back together is adduction. Okay. I always think of it, if somebody's going to abduct me, I'm going to...
Taking you away.
Taking you away, yeah. Move your arms away. Okay, let's see. Circumduction and rotation are not paired. They do not have a bracket around them. So circumduction is by itself a standalone action in our synovial joints. Circumduct sounds like circle, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you take your arms or even your legs, I feel like one of those jokes where pat your belly and rub your head, you know, that's what circumduction is. So circumduction is moving those body parts in a circular motion. It's actually a combination of abduction, adduction, flexion, and extension. Okay, so we can just think of it like little kids saying, I'm an airplane, and doing their arms in a circular motion. Let's see, rotation is also one of those standalone actions. Can you rotate your head?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you say, no, I can't rotate my head, you're doing it, right? Okay, can you rotate your humerus and your glenoid cavity? Yeah, you can rotate your arm that way. A little harder to do your leg, but, you know, we can rotate the head of the femur and the acetabulum, too. So rotation is just a longitudinal movement of a bone around its axis. Let's see. We've got two more paired ones here. Pronation with a P, supination with an S. So you want to do pronation? It's zombie month, right? It's October. Okay, so zombies are walking in a prone position. I don't know, the zombie movies don't have them like this, do they? Okay, well, at any rate, prone is, of course, yeah, palms down, P for P, right? Palms posterior. And then supination, palms up, right? So if you're carrying a soup bowl, you are supinating, okay? So that's another way to keep that one straight. So just to review, we've got a couple of special activities here. Where in particular do dorsiflexion and plantar flexion occur?
Foot.
Foot, right. And how about supination and pronation?
Hands.
Hands, good, in that wrist area. Let's see, we've got two more just for the ankle and foot area. We've got inversion and eversion. Inversion means you're turning the sole of your foot in what direction?
Inward,
right. So if you step on chewing gum and you're looking to see if it's on your shoe, turn your foot inward along the midline is inversion. How would you evert your foot?
Turn it that way.
away from the midline. Yeah, turn it out. Exactly. Let's see. Elevation and depression can be done by your jaw. You can also elevate or depress your shoulders. So if you shrug your shoulders, you're basically elevating and depressing your shoulders. If you shut your mouth, you're doing elevation of your jaw, right? Or if your jaw drops open, it's now depressing your jaw. So we usually think about our shoulders and our mouth or jaw as being two parts that we can elevate or depress. All right, and the last two, what body part can you protract and retract?
Your mouth.
Your mouth, yeah. Which the particular bone? Mandible. Good. So to retract your jaw is to pull it back inward, right? And to protract it is to push it out, right? So if people have to wear headgear for braces, it is to reset the way that jaw is aligned. Okay. So think about these when you're doing your muscle flashcards, when you're learning that for your next lab test. And that is actually it for articulations. There are pictures on page 75 with answers at the bottom. I'd like to cover just a little bit of muscle tissue to make sure we stay on pace. Do y'all have any questions so far on articulations? Okay, let's see. We're going to move on over to page 76. This is chapter 10. We're going to be looking at muscle tissue in this chapter. At the very top of your page, you've got about four different functions for muscle tissue. And let me emphasize, what we're really talking about is muscle tissue in the skeletal form. We're not necessarily talking about cardiac muscle or smooth muscle. Instead, the focus at the very top of your page is for skeletal muscle. All right, so we know movement is a big job here, right? Okay, is that movement for your skeletal muscles voluntary or involuntary?
Voluntary,
good. Second function here is to maintain posture. You know, gravity makes us work. In order to stand up straight, in order to sit up straight, we have to have strong muscle tissue. Without strong muscle tissue, then gravity does a good job of pulling us down. So people who go in outer space, you know, they got the space station set up, and people are spending upwards of 6 months to a year on those space stations. When they come home, if they don't exercise in outer space, what happens to their posture? They hunch over. They don't have the muscle tone to be able to stand up against gravity, and they'd be really weak. Years ago, when they had space shuttle programs, they would bring home the astronauts on the space shuttle, and they would load them onto stretchers. And people, you know, watching TV saw these people being brought from outer space back onto Earth, and they thought, gosh, you know, outer space must make you sick. Well, it wasn't necessarily that it made you sick, it made you weak. So, yeah, nowadays, if you happen to see people on the space stations, they're using those Bowflex machines or, you know, some kind of resistance training to make sure those muscles stay strong, so when they come home 6 months or a year later, they can actually stand up and have posture. So pretty interesting stuff. Muscles also stabilize joints. You know, think about your hip. You know, that's a lot going on with that acetabulum and the head of the femur, or even around your shoulder joint. You've got a lot of muscles there that help to stabilize that joint as well. So stabilizing joints is a third major job. And then fourth here, generating heat. Okay, so if you are cold, what do your muscles do?
They shiver,
exactly. So, you know, if you need to warm up, that muscle tissue burns ATP, and the burning of that ATP to generate movement is partly what heats your body up. And then your blood distributes that heat around your body. Okay. Middle of your page, you've got three functions there, muscle characteristics. All right, so muscle tissue is excitable. What does that mean it can do?
Reacts to a stimulus.
If you zap that muscle tissue with a neurotransmitter, it's going to respond to it if it can. So we think of excitability as something that not only muscle tissue can do, but also nervous tissue as well. Muscle tissue also contracts upon stimulation. And when it contracts, you'll notice that parts of the muscle tissue actually slide and get shorter. I don't want to necessarily say that contraction is shortening, but that's a real kind of a shortcut way to keep it straight. So muscle tissue shortens upon excitement, and that's what is going to lead to the movement. And then finally, muscle tissue has elasticity. So if you think about a rubber band, you know, good rubber bands are ones that stretch and pop back into their original position. Like underwear, bad rubber bands stretch, and when you let go, what happens to them? They stay stretched, yeah. So we don't want to have muscle tissue that is flabby. We especially don't want heart muscle tissue that is flabby. We want our muscle tissue to be strong and elastic. We want it to pop back and recoil into its original position. So that means that the muscle tissue is healthy and can perform its contractions. Let me give you a moment to figure out what three muscle tissue types you've got there on your worksheet. What do you think about the first picture?
Cardiac.
Good. Of course, cardiac muscle tissue has a couple of really unique features. Intercalated discs. Good. Those things here, these dark lines, are actually gap junctions. So this is a great time to review gap junctions once again. Are these open doorways between neighboring cells, or do they prevent?
Open
doorways. Right. If you want your muscle tissue to contract as a unit, you've got to have an open doorway and let those nerve impulses and ions travel directly from one cell to the next through those gap junctions. Okay. Cardiac muscle is found where? Good. Voluntary or involuntary?
Involuntary.
Involuntary. Good. Branched or not branched?
Branched.
Branched. Good. All right. Let's see, our middle picture, what do you think? Good. It is lacking what? Good. Found where? Good. Walls of hollow organs. Good. So we could say digestive tract, blood vessels, urinary system has a lot of smooth muscle tissue. Are the contractions voluntary or involuntary?
Involuntary.
Involuntary. Good. All right. And then last one, we've got skeletal muscle tissue, okay? And it has striations, just like which other tissue?
Cardiac.
Cardiac, good. This particular tissue moves?
Voluntary control.
Voluntary control, good. Moves those bones voluntarily, good. This muscle tissue, branched or not?
Not.
Not branched, right. Multinucleate or uninucleate?
Multinucleate,
right, lots of nuclei scattered through here. So skeletal muscle is really going to be our focus in this chapter. We're not going to worry too much about cardiac or smooth muscle. You'll pick up cardiac when you get into Bio 211, and smooth muscle we'll talk about in there as well. But this chapter is really going to focus on skeletal muscle. Do you have questions on this first page? So let's take a look at page 77. We're going to first look at what's called macroscopic anatomy of a skeletal muscle. And I should tell you, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this page, skeletal muscle cell is the same thing as a skeletal muscle fiber. And the reason for that is when our bodies form and when our muscle tissue grows, multiple muscle cells actually fuse together. So, you know, in your leg, you've got that really long sartorius muscle. You've also got really long quadriceps muscles there. These muscles are made up of fused skeletal cells that make long, long fibers. So that's why we end up with a multi-nucleate setup. We've actually got multiple skeletal muscle cells fused there. Thinking back, is muscle tissue, skeletal muscle tissue, something that heals quickly or slowly? Slowly, yeah. So if you damage skeletal muscle tissue, you have to go through this rebuilding process of letting multiple muscle cells join and making a really long fiber. So no wonder if you tear muscle tissue, you're having to wait for something that's possibly 18 inches long to rebuild. And so that's quite a process that our bodies have to undergo. Okay, so we're going to talk about this picture. It's about halfway down your page. I'm going to help you label this thing. So we're looking first off at a type of membrane that wraps the outside of skeletal muscles. This is the blank for number one at the top of your page. It's called?
Epimycium.
Yeah, epimycium. Good. Big piece on the outside. All right, so if you look inside this muscle, let's just pretend that we've taken a biceps brachii, we've cut it in half, and we're looking at a bunch of muscle cells there poking out. So we can see very easily the outside wrapping is epimycium. You can see that with the naked eye. I don't mean to make you sick, but if you've ever cooked roast or pork roast or beef roast, there often looks to be like a little membrane that kind of cooks off the meat. You're probably getting epimycium or perimycium, which is the wrapping around muscle cell groupings that kind of cooks free from those muscle fibers. The meat itself, of course, is muscle fibers, and it does come off in what looks to be long strings. So this next wrapping right through here is called our perimycium. It's called our perimycium. Or you can call it perimycium. Is wrapping around a bundle of muscle cells, or you can call them muscle fibers. Hey, keep those prefixes straight, right? Outside is epi, peri is around, and then endo is found inside, yep. So I colored it blue so we could see it. This outer wrapping around your muscle cell is called number three, your endomycium. So you may just want to shade around. So endomycium or endomycium, that is your muscle, individual muscle cell wrappings.
So is that the inside? Was it inside or the outside?
Yeah, I would take your pencil or pen and shade around your muscle cell.
So it's the blue part.
It's the blue part, yeah.
Okay.
So just to kind of give us the big picture here, these are connective tissue membranes. They wrap, they cover, and they kind of insulate around or protect around this muscle cell. They do actually extend away from your muscle, and you can see the stuff down here coming away. That's actually going to form a tendon that helps connect your muscle to a bone. Okay, So just to kind of give you a big picture, this piece here is a tendon. And we know that tendons connect muscles to bones. Just want to show you something real quick. You know, when you're thinking about Achilles tendon, that's actually just kind of a piece of that connective tissue wrapping that exits the muscle, and you can see it connecting to your heel bone. And then over here you can see on the top of the head there's a piece of connective tissue that connects your frontalis muscle to your occipitalis muscle at the back, and that piece of connective tissue is called an aponeurosis. So, you know, kind of cool that we start getting to see how things connect together now, and we use connective tissues that wrap those muscles to form these other connectors to bones and back to other muscles. Okay, down near the bottom of your page, we're gonna work on an individual muscle cell. The number one blank at the very bottom is for the term sarcolemma. Number one at the very bottom of your page is called sarcolemma. Let me emphasize, the word sarco means flesh or muscle, so that's a good thing to keep in mind. And the cytoplasm inside your cell is called, guess what?
Sarcoplasm.
Yep, sarcoplasm, so that's your next blank there, right underneath. Sarcoplasm. And then finally, what you've got down below are called number two, myofibril, and that one's actually labeled here. It's a tiny organelle inside your muscle cell. Number two is tiny, tiny myofibril. It's a little organelle. So these words don't make a bit of sense, do they? Okay, what I'd like to do is just rebuild this page, but this time use straws, paper plates, and napkins. Okay, I think it'll make better sense if we build this muscle. So what I've got is a drinking straw. It's got a plastic wrapper or a paper wrapper on the outside. I pulled the wrapper back so that you can see the straws exposed underneath. This is my muscle cell, the straw, and the wrapping around it is actually our endomycelium. So when I cover up that straw, you actually can't see my straw anymore, which is the muscle cell. So you're looking only at the endomycelium, which wraps the outside of that muscle cell. Let me pull back that endomycelium, and now you can see I've got a yellow striped straw. That straw itself has a plasma membrane that you can see. It is called?
Sarcolemma.
Good. And if you looked inside, you would find a special cytoplasm called?
Sarcoplasm.
Sarcoplasm, good. And if we were really good, we could even get a microscope and see these long organelles coming out of that muscle cell. And they are called?
Myofibrils.
Myofibrils, right. And you can see I've got a coffee stir behaving as my myofibril. It too has a wrapping around it. We'll talk about that later on. So I'm going to put my myofibril inside my muscle cell. I'm going to cover it back up with its endomycelium. And what I'm holding now is a bundle of muscle cells. These are called fascicles. Okay, so a fascicle is just an alternate name for a bundle. So I've got a bundle of muscle cells, and I need to wrap this bundle with the covering called
perimycelium.
Yeah. So I'm going to use a napkin. This is high tech, right? Okay. I'm going to wrap it up. And now I've got a bundle of muscle cells covered and wrapped by a paper napkin. That is my perimycelium. Okay. I've got another fascicle of muscle cells all wrapped by a perimycium. Okay. And we could just keep adding to these. But what I need to do is keep them all held together as a unit. So now I've got a paper plate. It's going to wrap on the outside. And this outermost wrapping is called
epimycium.
Good. So basically you can go home and build yourself a muscle. You can do the same thing with straws. People have done this with spaghetti. So, you know, whatever you like to use, you can basically build your own muscle at home.
It looks like a burrito.
It does look like a burrito. All right. Want to do it again, or do you feel okay?
Yeah.
Do it again. Okay. Let's do it. Let's deconstruct it this time. Okay. So outside wrapping is called
epimycium.
Take it off, and I have bundles of muscle cells. The bundles are called
fascicles,
and they're each wrapped by a membrane called
perimycium.
Good. Let's take one fascicle and take out one muscle cell. One muscle cell is wrapped by a covering called
endomycium.
Pull back that covering and you can see the muscle cell's plasma membrane or
sarcolemma.
And look inside, you can see the cytoplasm, also called
sarcoplasm,
right. And if we got a microscope, we could also find these long, skinny organelles in there called
myofibrils.
Good. All right. And we'll probably do this again if you need to hear it before the next test, because this is not on Monday. This is on the next one, right?
Right.
Okay. So that's pretty much where I wanted to get you today. That's the bottom of 77. And then what we need to do next Wednesday is start working on pages 79 and 80. So we'll save that stuff for later. All right, the floor is yours for questions. Anything with tissues? Membranes? How are you doing with those tissue functions, locations, things like that? How about questions on anything with skin, epidermis structure, dermis, skin functions, accessory glands, nair? Nails. I'm trying to combine the two. Yeah, nair. Nair is for hair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Nails, hair, anything of that sort.
What about the stratum and the different layers?
Different layers. Okay, let's hit that. Okay, so going back to the epidermis is the uppermost of the two skin layers, and it may have four or five strata, depending on where you're at in the body. So, you can't see that really, can you? Let's put the screen down. Okay, so in what parts of your body might you expect to find stratum lucidum? Palms and soles, good. Everywhere else, you know, the skin of your forearm, the skin of your forehead, you know, your stomach, everywhere else in your body should only have four layers of the epidermis. The most superficial layer is called corneum. Yep, stratum corneum. And the newest cells are made at stratum basal, good. The majority of the cells coming up through the skin's layers are melanocytes, keratinocytes, Langerhans.
Okay.
And in fact, you know, let's talk about that, because those melanocytes, they like kind of break off their arms. You know, little tiny melanosomes break off. And those packets of melanin get trapped in your keratinocytes, and all of that travels together toward the topmost layers of your skin. So it's in fact that the melanin packets are riding inside a keratin cell. So kind of cool how that works. Let's see, the thickest part of your epidermis is a bunch of dead layers found in which stratum?
Corneum,
good. And cells are held together by bands. Those bands are a type of cell junction known as?
Desmosomes,
good. Okay, let's see, let's talk about the dermis. The dermis has two layers. It has an upper layer called? Papillary layer,
yeah.
And a deeper region called the
reticular
layer. Good. It's to keep it alphabetical, right?
Yeah.
And the kinds of tissues common to your dermis? Irregular, good. And
connective.
Loose areolar. So two tissues common to your dermis are it's irregular and loose areolar. Part of what makes it a really tough tissue. All right, let's think about dermis versus epidermis. Which region contains blood vessels?
Dermis,
good. Which region contains collagen fibers?
Dermis,
yeah. Which region protects us from UV radiation?
Epidermis,
good. Which portion contains melanocytes?
Epidermis.
Epidermis has those melanocytes. Where would you find, say, reticular fibers or elastic fibers?
Dermis,
good. Where might you find nerve fibers that allow you to sense the world around you?
Dermis.
Let's see. What is the layer sitting down beneath your dermis? Hypo, good. And is that part of your skin?
No.
No, good. It's just a connective layer, mostly made up of what kind of tissue?
Adipose,
good. Or? Loose areolar. Yeah, good. How about questions on components of the epidermis, dermis, hypodermis?
Okay. So, the keratin, most studies. Where?
They are the most common cell in your epidermis.
Epidermis, yeah. Keratin cells. Yeah. Melanocytes are in the epidermis as well?
Yes.
Okay.
And all this kind of a darker stuff down here, those are like melanocytes, and then they like break their arms off and they travel up. Yeah.
Right.
Let's see, fingerprints and footprints are actually ridges known as? Papillae, yeah. And this grooviness that you see here is actually projected up onto the topmost layer, and that's how you see fingerprints and footprints. Good. In this picture, where is stratum basal? At your basement membrane. So is it right through here? Or is it down here?
Down here.
And it's at that groovy junction, right?
Right.
Okay. Let's see. How about other questions on skin?
Can we go over the burns?
Yeah, we can do burns. Okay, so let me just remind you that there is a rule of nines that helps us estimate the part of the body that's been burned by whether it's heat or sunlight or hot water, whatever it is. So we can estimate the percentage of the skin that's been damaged through a type of burn using that rule of nines. The thing to keep in mind is that the burn depth is basically numbered from 1 to 4, and the layer of skin that's being affected is going to then dictate to us what kind of degree burn we have. If only the epidermis is affected, what layer of skin is burned?
First degree,
good. And a first degree burn is often just inflammation. What are the four cardinal signs of inflammation?
Red,
hot, swollen, painful, right? Okay. Do you expect to find blisters with a first degree? What type of burn has blisters?
Second degree.
And a second degree can burn how deep?
The dermis.
All the way to the dermis, right. So this too can be painful because you can still affect those sensory receptors. So first degrees and second degrees can be very painful. Why is a third degree burn often not painful?
Nerves
are damaged. And in this case, to repair the skin, we have to use a graft in order to get that skin to regrow. So you can see we've actually burned down into that hypodermis region down below. Let's see, a fourth degree burn will burn beyond the hypodermis into either muscle tissue or bone, whatever's underneath, and that is the most severe type of burn a person can experience. Okay, and that may in fact be painful because you're now burning nerve receptors that are down in those deeper tissues. All right, so some things to look for. Blisters are found at which level?
Second degree.
Blackened, charred, ashy type skin is found with a
third degree,
right. Pain-free is found with
third degree,
right. All right. And, of course, skin grafts may be needed for
third and fourth.
Okay. Any questions on any of these burns?
These are the third degree can be charred.
It can be charred, yeah. Any questions about skin cancers? Thermoregulation? In the past for burns, I've said, okay, you've got a clinic with people that have walked in with burns. Who do you treat first? How would you differentiate between the different kinds of burns? That's the kind of thing I might ask.
Yeah. Questions about ossification?
Most of the ossification questions are built into the multiple choice, but you do want to look at why that epiphyseal plate is important, what ages can experience lengthening or long growth, you know. That's something really to look at for primarily multiple choice questions. Don't worry about the difference between those. I don't think I ask anything on this test for that. Yeah. There are questions about UVA versus UVB. Don't worry about knowing the difference between what those impact. Yeah, treat the fourth degree, basically in reverse order, fourth, third, second, and then first. Yeah. Do you feel better about this test than about test one?
Yes.
That's good, because, chemistry is a pretty tough one. What are you finding is the topic you most don't like or can't get to stick about these three chapters? The layers, tissues, okay. How about bones? Could you label the parts of a long bone? Could you tell me the difference between, say, an epiphyseal plate and a line?
Yeah.
Okay. Could you tell me why it's important for a child to have a plate? For bone growth, right?
Yeah.
And can you tell me what type of bone growth occurs throughout your entire lifetime?
Yeah.
appositional.
Yeah,
which makes your bones grow
longer.
Wider. Yeah. Anything you'd like to hear again from bones? Oh, like calcitonin, parathyroid. That's good. Okay. Let's recover those bones, those hormones that influence bone growth. Okay, so hormones travel through the bloodstream. They are communicators, and the first two hormones there actually have different messages for bones. Parathyroid hormone comes from a gland in your neck called the parathyroid glands, and when it's activated, it tells the bones in your body to break down. It uses a type of bone-destroying cell known as
osteoclast,
right. And when osteoclasts break down your bone, they increase your blood calcium levels. We're going to learn in the muscle and nerve chapters that calcium is really important for your muscles to contract and your nerves to be able to send nerve impulse transmissions. So we've got to have enough calcium in our bloodstream for our bodies to function, and you can always raid your bones and break it down using PTH if you need to increase calcium levels. Calcitonin works opposite to PTH. So instead of breaking down bone, what does calcitonin do for bone?
Builds
it, right. Now it activates a bone-forming cell called?
Osteoblast,
right. And if you're under, say, age 18, where might you expect to see bone growth occur? Right at the plate. Yeah, there's an ossification center right by that plate, and we start laying down bone right underneath that epiphyseal plate. If you're 38 years old, you would not expect to see bone growth at the ends of your bones, but rather where? The width, yeah. So calcitonin will make your bones grow wider if you're beyond, say, the age of 18 to 21, okay? So those first two, PTH and calcitonin, are actually antagonists. They come from a very similar location. Calcitonin comes from your thyroid gland. PTH comes from parathyroid glands. We'll spend a lot of time talking about these things combined to, and actually the first 2 weeks we'll talk about this again. Growth hormone also encourages bone growth, and it is going to be one that promotes all bones to grow, not just bone growth. So we expect to see growth hormone especially high during what time of your life?
Childhood,
yeah, because once you reach adulthood, we really don't want to see excess growth hormone. So if you happen to be, say, 50 years old and you have too much growth hormone in your body, which of these three conditions might you develop?
Acromegaly,
good. What kind of symptoms? How would we know you have this? Yeah, enlarged features, enlarged hands and feet. Yep. Would you be growing taller? Because you're 50, right? And you're not growing taller at 50. Your bones just grow
wider.
Yeah, what kind of growth is that?
Appositional.
Good. Okay, so if you're 5 years old and you're having excess growth hormone, which of the disorders might you develop?
Giantism,
right. And so that disorder means that we end up having excess upward growth. Is that endochondral ossification or appositional ossification?
Endochondral,
exactly, good. And so a person with pituitary dwarfism has what issue with growth hormone? Too little, not enough, exactly. So we expect to see a body size under about 4'7". Let's see, we also talked on that same page. Oh, and by the way, growth hormone comes from the pituitary gland. We'll cover a lot more detail with that come 2:11. And then we also talked about things like sex hormones, vitamin D, thyroid hormone. So thyroid hormone encourages bone growth. Sex hormones encourage a fast jolt of bone growth. And then, of course, the plates turn into lines. And then, let's see, we had exercise. So that kind of completes that page. Okay. Do you have any questions? Anything I can go back and hit again on that page for you? How about your next topic? Fractures. The types of fractures or the whole page? Whole page? Okay. Fractures can be open or closed. If they're open, they poke through your skin. If they're closed, what happens? Doesn't poke through your skin. And which one of those will give you a higher chance for an infection in your bones?
Open.
Yeah, open fracture can cause osteomyelitis, very painful bone condition. Technically, it's an infection inside those bones. Okay. And so if a bone is broken, it can be fixed by either closed reduction, manually setting the bones back in position, or through open reduction, which is surgery to pin those bones back together. Okay. So in terms of bone healing, it's about a 4 to 6 week process, and it begins by having a blood clot form over the area of the break. What's the fancy word for the blood clot?
Hematoma.
Hematoma, good. And we follow that up by placing a type of cartilage around that broken bone. What kind of cartilage?
Fibrocartilage.
Fibrocartilage, good. Hey, just as a review, where is fibrocartilage normally found? Knees and intervertebral discs. Yeah. So it's a very tough tissue. It's a great one to start the repair process, but it's not the permanent repair because we come along now with bone. It's called a bony callus, and that helps to regrow the bone where it was broken. And finally, we have to kind of trim this up and make it look nice. So we have remodeling that occurs during the last stage. Osteoclast can come in this time and basically remove any excess bone. That way it looks more functional and works like it should. So bone healing occurs. And then I did want to share with you the five types of fractures at the bottom of your page. So what population, young people or old people, have green stick?
Young people,
right. And is this a complete break? Not a complete break. It is an incomplete break, just like a green stick on a tree. It's very hard to break brand new green wood coming off of a tree. So, same concept.
Yeah.
I don't know that I see fractures in the fingers. I think it's almost like this. So I think you're seeing overlaps of bones. Yeah. All right, so who is more likely for a compressed fracture?
Old person,
right, because of things like osteoporosis and osteomalacia, right? So we may see bones, you know, like these here in the body region actually start to crumble and collapse. Depressed fractures can come from something like a ball hitting you in the head. Ouch. Okay. And then spiral fractures can be sports related. Again, a twist of the bone is what may produce a spiral fracture. And this last one here, comminuted fracture, is how many? Yeah, more than one. It's a bunch of different breaks in those bones. So unfortunately, this is going to require surgery to pin those bone pieces back together. If we talked about, say, old people fractures versus young people fractures, could you give me an example of each?
Yes.
Compressed for older people?
Green stick
for younger people. Good. Can you tell me what conditions might lead to compressed fractures?
Osteoporosis
and osteomalacia. And speaking of osteomalacia, it is a vitamin deficiency. Which vitamin?
Vitamin D.
Vitamin D. Good. And how do you make vitamin D?
Sunlight.
Sunlight. Drinking milk. Good. All right. How about your next topic? Which one? Not on this test, yeah.
That's the day.
Percentage of what? No, just know that that's what we use to predict burns, but I'm not going to give it in, I'm not going to have you calculate anything. Yeah.
Okay, in the essay, are you going to have us look at ABCDE thing?
I would look at ABCDE right for melanoma. Yeah. Be able to tell me what each letter stands for. Yeah, and that kind of essay. That's in skin cancer at the very last of chapter 5. Looks like it's on page 62. Okay, so in terms of compact bone structure, what we're looking at here is called an osteon. We also call it a Haversian system. And this osteon is made up of rings of calcium salt. The name for these rings is?
Lamellae.
Good. And these rings have embedded osteocytes. Good. And they're trapped in an air pocket known as?
Lacunae.
Good. And these lacunae actually have little canals connecting them back to our central canal. These are called?
Canaliculi.
Good. And that's the way we get nutrients out to those cells. And it just makes you feel dirty saying it, doesn't it? It does sound like a tongue twister, yeah, a nasty one. So that osteon is repeated over and over in bone tissue. It basically consists of your canal in the middle, that central canal, rings of lamellae, osteocytes and lacuna, and the little teeny tiny canaliculi that connect us back to that central canal. So what looks like little radiating strands coming out here are in fact those canaliculi. And sometimes you'll actually get to see a perforating canal, one of these here that lays horizontal. It connects one central canal to another central canal. So it runs across in that way. So when we back it off a bit and look big scale, this is what we've got, is lots and lots of osteons, and these are all central canals. They house either a blood vessel or a nerve. And so in terms of spongy bone, we do not expect to see osteons. Instead, we expect to see trabeculae, and those are just bony bars that provide strength for that spongy bone. But no osteons here, not that same setup with all the canals when you're looking at spongy bone. Do you have questions on compact versus spongy? Okay, how about your next topic?
We don't have to label the skin thing like the dermis. Or
it'll be a multiple choice. Yeah. Yeah, the epidermis and dermis stuff.
No, I guess it is. You know, we got the sebaceous gland or the eccrine gland.
Yeah. It'll be a multiple choice. Let me see if I can find that picture for you. It's this picture, and I may ask you, epidermis, dermis, that's a sweat gland because it's not hooked to a hair. This is an oil gland because it is hooked to a hair. It could be an apocrine sweat gland, but the assumption is sebaceous glands are always hooked up to hairs. And then there's your erector pili muscle that can make that hair stand up on end. Okay. So yeah, this picture's on there. Make sure you feel comfortable with it. It's like two questions as a multiple choice setup. How about other questions?
Yeah.
I know some of you have lab tests, right? Well, if that room is empty, then you're welcome to come in and study until that lab test is set up.